the rollout of new top-level domains, and that modifications should be incorporated to allow the UDRP to address charter violations in restricted top-level domains. And finally, the IPC committed itself to work as part of a task force made up of representatives of all of the constituencies to look at the issues surrounding the rollout of new top-level domains and to work with others to make sure that this is smooth and as effective as possible. Now, that's a very, very brief summary. There are a lot of details that I have just glossed over, some of the fine points. Again, if you looked at the responses that we include in our paper, you will see the details there. For those of you who have seen the agenda, if you have one, we have Roger Cocchetti, I believe, is it not, Mike, coming at some point. We have him listed at 2 p.m. to come in and talk with us about some topics of interest, at least to us. I think you'll find that as well. And while I'm picking on you, Mike, you were the principal leader in terms of the guidelines for the new top-level domain registries. If you wouldn't mind saying a few words about that paper now, if you would. Yes. All right. The rest of you, be aware that I'm going to ask you when the time comes for the papers you've worked on, and you know who you are. I'm going to call on you. So.
Well, the paper, or this really was born out of...
Turn the mic on, make sure that we get recorded.
The paper was really born out of the Names Council resolution, which... said that, you know, there essentially it said that there should be some type of intellectual property protection. It would depend on the TLD. And so then obviously it's going up to the ICANN board, and we began thinking to ourselves, well, by what criteria should the ICANN board judge whether or not the intellectual property protections in a registry application are just and are appropriate? And so I put together an initial draft, and then at the meeting in Washington, the rest of the intellectual property constituency shared their views, and the document was amended accordingly. I'll just run through the 4 points very, very quickly. They, in some respects, correspond to what is in our submission to ICANN regarding the new GTLD questionnaire. An effective means for notifying the internet community concerning the activation of any new TLD. In other words, the registry has got to let people know that they're out there and that they're going to be starting business. The second is the creation of the free real-time access via the internet to a current centralized database of contact data, essentially who is. The third is the opportunity in all unrestricted TLDs and restricted TLDs until and unless experience demonstrates that a chartered or restricted TLD will not be subject to abuse, that during a period certain for the owner of a valid national trademark registration aged at least 1 year to pre-register its trademark in the new TLD. Now, you all remember that as the Sunrise proposal, we have significantly toned that down and to just the trademark registration itself, the mark that you have the registration for, and that's it. The IPC was very sensitive to the comments and understands the comments regarding the 20 variations, and so we have taken action accordingly. The fourth is the cancellation procedure and or provisions for a UDRP action if a registrant is found later to have provided false or misleading information, registered in a restricted TLD in violation of the charter, or operated in a manner that is not consistent with the charter. Now, these are our suggestions to the ICANN board. We're saying, look at these, look to see whether or not a prospective registry or registry applicant has these four criteria in place. And then finally, it was felt in Washington, and this provision was specifically added in Washington, or this amendment, that said that ICANN should verify and make sure that the registry is following through with these four criteria and other things when they are operating the registry, and that a failure to follow through on these could result in the registry being taken away from the administrator who is not following through and transferred to another administrator. And that's it.
Okay. After we go through all of these papers, I thought we would stop at that point and allow those who are not members of the IPC, if they wish, to ask questions. Next, Steve Metallitz has been working diligently both back in our first meeting in February and or our first meeting this year, which was in February, and then again in June on the best practices for CCTLD. So, Steve, if you would.
Thank you. The thrust of the work that we've been doing in this area really goes back to the 5 points, or a variation on the 5 points that Mike read out at the beginning of the meeting, procedures that ought to be in place for new TLDs, we think are also close to what ought to be in place for CCTLDs to, in order to run those domains in a way that will minimize the threat of intellectual property infringement. We posted a statement on this just prior to the Cairo meeting, and then had some contact with the CCTLD through some contacts actually that Mike Heltzer made in Cairo with the CCTLD people, and looked at their best practices draft. On June 12th, the CCTLD constituency posted a new draft of their best practice guidelines, which are intended to lay out what practices the CCTLD should follow. And we last week posted comments on those, which again basically line up the CCTLD best practice guidelines with our 5 points on recommended procedures. I won't go through all of these except to say that the main area where we felt a lot of concern about the CCTLD best practice guidelines is in the area of who is, or of the availability of registrant contact data. The best practice guideline has, we thought, a very weak provision on that, and we urged the constituency to move more toward the situation that prevails with the other TLDs. I should say that I think that the CCTLD guidelines have come a good distance toward our position on the question of dispute resolution. If you look at what's in the June 12th paper, it is quite close, I think, to what we would be looking for from the CCTLDs. I wanted to mention that I think it was late last week, the ICANN staff posted another document on CCTLDs and included a draft status quo agreement between ICANN and the CCTLDs. And of course, we as the IPC haven't had any chance to look at that or discuss it. So I simply posted in the comment forum on that that we had not had a chance to discuss it, but that I gave people the link to the point on our website where we had posted these comments on the CCTLD best practice guidelines. I spoke this morning to Anthony Van Coovering. I don't think he's here now, although I invited him to come by this meeting, who said he had received, he's one of the CCTLD leaders to whom I had sent these comments. He had received them. He said he thought that some of them could be incorporated in their next draft. So we will continue to work on that.
Okay, Steve, thank you very much for your work on that, because I know you've been engaging in outreach to the CCTLD constituency, and I think that's extremely useful. David Tatum, picking on you since you're late and just walking in the room, and since you had a lot to do with the creation of the Daybreak proposal, you might explain that. Mike Heltzer, before you came, mentioned it briefly, but you might just expand on that a little bit and talk about that, if you would, for those in the room that may not be familiar with it. I have a copy here if you wish. David, if you would, one of the three microphones, would come up here if you like. Just flip the button there.
Yeah, okay, now I can. You can see me instead of my back. this was a proposal, you may recall, that in Cairo, that we were working in close conjunction with a number of the registrars to try and find some form of protection for trademarks with the opening of new GTLDs. And they came up with a somewhat imaginative proposal, which they called the Sunrise Plus 20, which allowed for the introduction when a new GTLD was introduced within the first 30 days. It would be possible for the owners of existing trademarks that were duly registered and protected, that in that 30 days they could protect that trademark exclusively to them within the 30-day, they called it the sunrise period. And the plus 20 came about because it was suggested that there should be not only the trademark itself, but 20 variants on that, but to a sort of protective wall around the trademark. Now, this went down quite well, as I recall, in Cairo. There were a number of loose ends that still needed to be tied up. But when I left Cairo, it seemed to be fairly acceptable to a group of influential people. But when people got home, they thought about it, and it wasn't so acceptable to them. And a number of objections were raised to it, to the actual proposal. So within the IPC, we said, okay, you don't like that. Let's come up with something else, a variant on that theme. And I was given the task to draft something, and we came up with what we call the Daybreak proposal to make it sound different from Sunrise, Daybreak. And this was literally just that within that same period of 30 days, the owner of a valid trademark registered in the world somewhere would have the opportunity within the first 30 days of the introduction of a new GTLD to protect that trademark as a domain name. He would have to pay for it in just the same way as anybody else, but within that 30 days he would have the exclusivity of protecting his trademarks. And we felt that this gave some protection to trademark owners to stop the scramble, the land rush, the gold rush, whatever you like to call it, that has been going on at present within the existing domain names, not only country code top levels, but also in the other generic top levels, whereby so many people's trademarks are being taken by other people, or variants are being taken by other people, and it takes time and money to sue the people who are doing it, and or to take them through the UDRP. UDRP is indeed, in my opinion, working quite well, but there was felt, nevertheless, that there needed to be some sort of additional protection for trademark owners, trade name owners, business name owners, whatever you like to call them, within this Daybreak period. And we've posted this document, I believe, Mike, about a week ago?
Yes.
On the website. There will obviously be copies available here. And there it is. And that's briefly, I hope I'm collecting my thoughts correctly.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, it is. At this point, let me just throw the floor open if there are any questions or comments from those of you who are outside of the IPC. On these documents. I think it might be useful not just for the Daybreak proposal, but also for the other documents that we have posted and discussed here at the moment. Yes, sir, there in the back.
Hi, Tom Barrett from NetNames. For the Daybreak proposal, was there any discussion about multiple owners of the same character stream with different classes?
We propose the first-come, first-served basis, yes. So there would certainly be a limited land rush, I would guess, when it was opened up. I can't actually see any other alternative to that other than the guys getting together and sorting it out amongst themselves, people would say, Ned. I haven't found a solution to that problem yet. But I'm open to offers.
I wonder if it has an impact on the UDRP where two legitimate owners of a character string. Obviously, one got the GTLD, the other one did not, and the race against the second one, you could perhaps give preference to one over the other in a UDRP.
Well, I don't think the UDRP is necessarily the right forum for doing that because it's so simple, it's just a bad faith. The courts unfortunately, do appear to be the right forum for sorting out who actually does have the correct rights in the name, the better rights in the name. Or they've got to come to, they've got to sit down around the table and sort it out between themselves if they've had the better rights. There's a hand on top of the question.
You may have sort of answered the question. I wanted to know, were you just discussing the mechanism that would be in place for major trademark disputes, for example, because there's a potential major one relationship between trademarks and domain names. How would the disputes between the rights owners be handled? Would it be done through the existing
as I say, it does seem to be working quite well. It is in place. It may need tweaking here and there. It may need a bit of. It's only been going for 7 months. But in that time, as we know, there have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of decisions. So I think we could say by now that we have a fairly good experience of the UDRP. But therefore, that's why I say perhaps it's time to look at it again. And to see that it needs changing.
And then disputes that arise between trademark holders that are trying to get the option to that corresponding domain.
Well, as I say, I don't really see any alternative to the UDRP at the moment, unless you can think of something.
I think what he's asking about, if you have two mark owners that are vying for the same mark, and they're both entitled under the Daybreak proposal, if I understand you correctly.
Well, that's first come, first served.
Yeah, that goes back to the first come, first served. Mike Helfer, you were raising your hand.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we did discuss that, and it's the classic United Van Lines versus United Airlines, right? It's the one I hear time and time again, and as David had indicated twice, it would be first come, first served, and then it would be really up to the parties, United Van Lines, United Airlines, to sit down at the table and try and come up with an equitable solution. One thing that we've been talking about, some of the folks with the INTA Internet Committee, is gateway pages
right.
is a possibility, and I know they've been discussed in other organizations. But that would really mean the two parties coming together and discussing how they could work out an agreement.
Would that have to be put forward into the user
agreement? Excuse me?
Would that have to be amended to the user agreement?
I believe that would just be a deal worked out between the two parties. I don't think you would need to involve ICANN with that at all or any other sort of ICANN agreements. It would be, you know, party A, party B sitting down with their lawyers and saying, let's work out a solution.
Yes.
Well, we assume that ICANN will give plenty of warning when the new GTLD is going to be open.
Well, the proposal itself talks about, again, bear in mind this is our suggestion to ICANN for how it might implement this, but it would suggest that there be a notice period to the general public, that they would have a 60-day notice period that a Daybreak window was going to open up. And so the mark owners would have to be alert to the fact and, you know, pay a little attention to what ICANN was doing. So if they looked at their website, they'd say, notice, here comes a new TLD, you know, window coming, be ready type of thing. So they would have that obligation according to the way we've suggested it. Now, there could be other ways to do it. Yes, sir, in the back there.
Are you saying this is a pre-registration, the Daybreak proposal, prior to open registration?
Our assumption was that it would be midnight on such and such a day, but no pre-registration.
So registration is open to all?
No, registration is open to trademark owners from midnight on day one. 30 days later, it's open to all.
And who does the verification?
Well, the registrars are unwilling to do that, as we understand it. So it would be a question of bad faith. If you've done it saying, I have got a valid trademark registration, and you haven't, subsequently discovers you haven't, then it will be taken down. There's another hand.
Yes.
Would there be any difference in trade for restricted or chartered?
That's another issue, which a lot of discussion within the IPC, which I wasn't present at, so
We did discuss that. Certainly there are arguments that one could make that this may not be necessary in a restricted or chartered TLD, and that may well be the case at the end of the day. On the other hand, to the extent that one could have considered, you know, .NET, for example, to be a chartered TLD at one point. It no longer is, you know, so it depends a lot on the implementation, the enforcement mechanisms of how tight the charter is, et cetera. So that's a bit of an open question, I would say, but yes, there is certainly the argument that it's less necessary than it would be in a generic. Yes, Mr. Park.
Under this proposal, the owner of a famous lot may register his famous lot and 20 variations through the sunlight period. There could be some variation with some people think it's not really variation. In that case, the
there's no possibility in the Daybreak proposal for variance. It's one mark. It's the trademark, and that's it. It's the word mark. Obviously, it doesn't apply to device marks. It can't, but it would be just the word mark. And also, it doesn't only apply to famous marks. It can apply to any trademark that's registered. That was the idea, that they would submit details of their trademark registration. If it's all being done on email anyway, it's obviously not possible necessarily to send a copy of the registration certificate, but ideally a copy of the registration certificate to the registrar would be the best proof that you do have a trademark, but otherwise just the details.
We had contemplated an application form where the individual applying for the registration would have to indicate the name of the mark, the date of registration, country of registration, and registration number. So clearly anybody that went through that and yet was still lying would have, you know, the most obvious bad faith. But all of that would have to be made available. Again, as David pointed out, the registrar would not have to worry, you know, itself about whether this was accurate. The owner of a mark that conflicted with that would obviously follow up and bring that to the appropriate authority's attention to take care of it. So the registrar would not have that burden.
So after the 30-day window, names that are generic, they would conform, such as Apple. If Apple didn't get to it in the 30 days, Apple then cannot go back and
I think on something like Apple, which is a generic term, I think that's a bit of an open question. If somebody were to try to get Apple and try to advertise products that indicated that it was trying to confuse the public as to it being the source of Apple computer, that's one situation. If it's somebody just registering Apple totally apart from that and the Apple Macintosh did not get that registration, then they would be SOL, as we say. Yes, Mike?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a distinction. You used the term generic and you referred it to Apple. Apple is actually what we call a dictionary term. It's not a generic term. Well, generics cannot be registered as a trademark, but a dictionary term can be registered as a trademark, so Apple can register it as for a computer services, but a computer company can't just call itself computers. That would be a generic term. So there's a difference. But in your case, like Mike said, the example you gave, you'd be really out of luck if Apple didn't take advantage of it and somebody else grabbed it.
So,
you could, you certainly could use the UDRP.
Yeah, they could begin acting in bad faith. Marilyn?
I have a really bizarre question, but let me see if I can articulate it.
From you, I can't imagine.
In the U.S., as I understand it, a company like mine has been trading under a name for 100 years, for a number of years. They have common law rights that may not necessarily hold a trademark registration. As I understand the scope of it now, is there a period of time that you have to actually have a trademark registration that you submit?
We had proposed 12 months.
Well, You might find, it might be worth kind of thinking about this, those of you who are in the legal profession, that in the U.S. you may actually have companies who have established common law rights in a name, but not, might not yet have filed trademark registration. So the period of time during which, you know, supposedly ICANN will do more than just do what I call pull, which is posting something on their website. Supposedly they will do something to do op-ed pieces, do advertising, but you might want to think about whether there may be a number of companies who, because of the differing characteristics of national law, might be caught in that.
We had talked about this at some length, you recall, in Washington, and I think the sense there was that you have to draw a line somewhere, because it gets to be a bit of a slippery slope if you say, well, you've got common law trademark rights, and then what's next, and you keep on going. And the thought was, look, is it really too much to ask a firm to have had a mark registered for 1 year? And you're saying, yes, it is, but I mean... Well, the IPC, to the extent that we have discussed this at length, disagrees with that point of view at this point.
And I think my environmental department, you might want to see really how pervasive the situation is within your own discussion.
Well,
the United States is out of step, and the rest of the world, as you well know, on this.
Guillermo.
I just want to let everybody know that there was a discussion about this issue, and it was submitted or voted as a minority vote. Trying to solve the issue, we said, can it only framework owners, but valid and fair users of the main name for a period of 1 year. So you don't leave all the startup companies that already have famous names but will not be able to get into a daybreak proposal and things like that. Unfortunately, the majority of the IPC thought otherwise, but there's a minority vote voted on that issue as an important that people don't have.
Yeah, let me just comment, and that's right. Thank you, Guillermo, for bringing that up. I mean, the thought was, because Guillermo, particularly in his organization, did press that point of view, and I think the majority of the IPC people, while sympathetic to something like that, thought that, you know, they did not want to be perceived as overreaching, if you will, and trying to cover too much. So it is something that will have to be sorted out, as assuming we start working forward on this. Mike?
Yeah, you had actually covered what I was going to say. I mean, we're all very sympathetic. We want to protect common law, and there was a discussion about, well, if you're an internet startup company, maybe you should try and protect that name as well. But it gets to be, you know, determining whether or not someone has common law rights in their trademark, you're going from sort of a very simple sort of bad faith judgment, then you're going into a much more intensive legal review of whether or not someone has common law rights. And so we thought that was beyond the scope of the UDRP, beyond the scope of asking a registrar. You know, you're going from one point saying, well, here's my valid trademark registration, and showing it to the registrar or the registry, whomever, to saying, okay, registry, could you please make a determination as to whether or not I have common law trademark rights? And the registrar or registry would say, We don't know nothing about that. You know, we're just techies. So, I mean, that was the thinking there. So clearly, you know, as I said in the meeting in Washington, my heart was certainly with Guillermo, but the gentleman who was arguing the other point, Jonathan Udis, I said, but my head and certainly is with Mr. Udis and the point that we need to draw the line somewhere.
Yes.
In today's environment. There are quite a few mergers and other types of changes going on in companies. Exxon and Mobil getting together and forming a new company, maybe with a new name. Maybe a couple of major communications companies in one country or another get together and change their name. Those names, those new names, they probably would not have been registered in the time period that you're talking about. Yet they are, I think, by anyone's standard, names that need some protection. Or might qualify under the Sunrise provisions. What do we do about that kind of situation?
Well, we're really only talking about new startups, the new GTLDs. So, I mean, what you're talking about is something that happens after. after it started up.
I was going to ask a question. Verizon, right?
That's really what we're raising. But, you know, the way I see it, we've got a new name. It's not going to have been registered 12 months. We introduced the name on April 3rd. We already have over 400 domain name infringers of the brand, you know, without a registration. Hopefully we'll get that soon. Our only hope is that the new GTLDs are rolled out slowly enough that we get an opportunity to get that registration for 12 months before they start proliferating. And obviously, we'll try to be first to register them. But if not, we're going to have to rely on bad faith. And we're fairly confident no one else in the world will have a federal or national registration for this brand because we have cleared it and are registering it.
Let me ask an interesting question, Sarah. When you came up with the name Verizon, was one of your very first steps to register domain names around to protect that?
We registered probably close to 500 variations in advance, and we registered in all the country codes.
Before you announced?
Before we announced.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a certain amount of self-help here.
400 infringers, though. The pace at which these new GTLDs are rolled out will, you know, the common law problem is an issue. It just depends how much we can slow it down.
Right.
Some countries have a dual registration process, like a federal system and a provincial state registration system. When you say, when you talk about the legal rights of those people who register their trademark in the system, are you including those states for the provincial registration or are you excluding those people?
Thinking about federal only, not state, it gets too complicated if you start thinking about that. Now, I don't know how many countries there are in the world that have got this particular system. I would obviously think about the United States. And then you also have a problem with the European community, because you have national and community trademarks, blah, blah, blah. So there's a problem there. But I don't know how many other countries there are that have got state registrations. Are you aware of any others?
In the United States, you have a state registration system. Also, in national standards, you have a national registration system. So if you have some trademarks have a legal rights in that specific state, but they cannot, have the legal rights in other states.
We were thinking basically of federal registration only rather than state, but that's up for discussion. If somebody can put up a good case for that, then so be it.
Yes, sir.
On the first come, first serve principle, does it mean that the first person to submit a name, let's say Sunrise, okay?
Daybreak.
Okay. I'm taking Sunrise for a very special reason. So Sunrise, the first day that I say, okay, I have a name Sunrise, yes. 30 days start from that day, is that correct?
Yes.
I see. Now, this Sunrise, for example, take again the Sunrise, I'm quite concerned about the medium in which the name is introduced. Okay? The Sunrise was introduced in Cairo, is that correct?
The Sunrise proposal was first brought to our attention by the registrars.
Okay, that was their idea, and then we took it.
Yeah, I want to know when was that. Was that in February?
In Cairo. Cairo. They brought it to Mike in, yeah.
March. Now, you see, coincidentally, in February, we developed a model for the UN called the Sunrise model. Okay? Now, the question is this. That Sunrise was announced in Cairo. We developed a model in February and called the Sunrise model. Coincidence. The question is that, where you announce it, this Sunrise model was announced in a media where you can get the first serve advantage. I'm quite worried in the sense that in some countries where there's no internet, if the announcement is going to be done on the internet, how are they going to be covered?
You would need a trademark registration if you're going to be able to take advantage of this particular.
Okay, I've registered it.
You've registered it.
That's correct.
Yes. Fine. Then you, if you get there first come.
Where is there?
Wherever the new GTLD is, we're talking about new top level domain names. When one is introduced,
yes.
The idea is that this procedure would come into being.
Yeah, what I mean is that where do I announce that, look, I have a trademark, so and so.
Well, presumably there will be a series of registrars announced at the same time, people who will accept applications for domain names in the new GTLD.
Well, I'm just concerned that if you have anything to do with having access to the internet, there's quite a chunk of the world now we don't have access to the internet. That's where I could put an example.
Mm.
That
will come to me, as far as I can,
directive of being determined at issue of outreach. I mean, just like when they opened it up for registrars, you know, again, and I'm sure there's many people that had no idea that they could now register.
That's correct.
In addition to NSI. So they're going out and they have to do a mass publication in different meetings to be sure that everyone knows about.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. Which media are we talking about? How that is reachable? I'm just raising that question.
Yeah. I want to present your proposal. I think that many countries on development, especially Latin America, Africa, would need definitely not only to promote this through ICANN website or registers, almost all registers are in the United States. Maybe we could add something that, in terms of promotion or outreach, it could be some funding or something to promote this in the media or newspapers or whatever in different countries of the world. Because I think you're right. If people don't know that something like this is put in place and only the big companies or registrars that have means to get internet, although it's business, I think well, like the contact I suggested and probably put it in the paper report.
That is a good suggestion, and I think this may be an area, for example, where WIPO could function because they have contact with all the countries that have trademark systems. And if you went through WIPO to all the countries with trademark systems and got to the officials through that mechanism, then they would at least be aware of it. But it's a good idea, and it's something that we had not focused on. Marilyn?
I'm going to make an associated point about some of you are familiar with what happened in the U.S. Council on Denial of Service attack when websites were basically bombarded and therefore not able to respond. In our filing, we put a significant amount of focus on the fact that the new registry should be able to deal with the very heavy load that they receive and what I call the Goldberg period. You might also think in your comments about whether ICANN should not pay attention to making sure that the registry and registrars are being able to accept this, because they'll be bombarded, it will be very much like the denial of service attack period.
See, yes.
Question about trademarks that have characters that don't map through the character space and domain name. Is there a logical mapping in terms of what I own Barnes & Noble, I'm entitled to Barnes&Noble.xx, or any thoughts
of that? Well, if you can't register it as a domain name, I don't see how it could apply in this particular proposal. I mean, I don't think they allow the ampersand sign, do they?
Correct. So no legitimate mapping for the holders of that, like AT&T. What can AT&T register under the same brand proposal?
ATANDT. Or I don't know. I have no idea.
Well,
I don't know what they do.
The proposal says the textural
elements, material textual elements. I mean, this is something because you get into the question, what about design marks? And it's something that we recognize will have to be worked through. Marilyn, in terms of what you have in terms of AT&T, what are your...
We registered ATT.
ATT as a domain name. Yeah. So... David, you've been on the hot seat for a long time. Welcome.
I just like, what do people feel?
Yeah.
Is it a good idea? Is it crazy? I mean, just a show of hands, perhaps, people generally in favor of the Daybreak proposal?
Come on, guys.
Good start.
No.
We got to start here.
Not in favor. About the same. Yeah. A lot of abstentions. Right, okay.
Thank you, David. Yes.
You described the Daybreak and the Sunrise proposal. Were there any other proposals that were serious contenders that you thought about and rejected for some reason?
Well, we started out with a proposal that you would allow famous marks to be registered with a penumbra around that, so that if you tried to register a domain name that differed only with a numeral or a comma or a dash or what have you, that would be blocked. But we ran into several problems, first and most serious of which was that the registrar said that you get into a filtering, you're going to slow down the registration process dramatically, and this simply, this pre-registration filtering was like a non-starter to them. They were also concerned about the possibility of liability if they registered something they shouldn't have. And then the more people thought about it, there's also the concern that while there is work going on in Geneva to develop a definition of what a well-known mark is, there is no universally available well-known mark list, and concern about what might happen if you were to develop such a list, the concerns that people would have about not being on the list. So the more that got talked about, the less exciting it became, and that's why the registrar proposal initially, which was Sunrise Plus 5, was thought to be something that would be useful. So that was at least one thing that was looked at. If we might just continue, Guillermo, you have been working on proposals for the enhancement of the UDRP. I think it might be useful if you could maybe come up and talk about that for a moment. This is a longer-term process, I think it would be fair to say, that Guillermo has taken the lead on.
Yes, basically, we have been discussing now preventive measures to avoid what's going to happen in the gold rush and try to prevent cyber squatter. So the Sunrise, Daybreak, the famous mark list are all mechanisms to try to prevent that. Now the enhanced UDRP proposal is basically a reactive measure and will depend basically on what would the ICANN board issue or release and this meeting. How are going to the new GTLDs be, how they would look like, and depending on that, I think it's important to consider some possible amendments to the UDRP. So far, there's been like a consensus, whatever a consensus is in ICANN means, but that UDRP is working. There's been a number of cases solved. From a perspective of cost, it's not that expensive. We've seen a lot of comments from, especially from panelists, that they are starting to get tons of documents and disclosures and a lot of work, and it's not being as attractive as it was in the beginning. So we have to continue scanning if the UDRP is working well, if it is working now. Well, as you know, the UDRP is a mechanism available already, especially for trademark owners, and our work is when you can prove bad faith on the people who have already registered. What we're considering is that the UDRP should continue to, all the TLDs that should be introduced should be subject to UDRP. That's a requirement that ICANN board should try to attempt. Then we believe that if they're going to be chartered or restricted new TDLDs, we suggest that they should be also included to be solved in front of the UDRP, specifically in cases that those people who are not compliant with the charter's scope of protection could go to UDRP and ask them to be removed. Third, we have been considering to extend the protection, not only for trademark owners, but famous names, persons, and other, like the Olympic symbols and international institutions that not necessarily are protected with a famous trademark. I heard somebody said that, for example, the Olympic Games and all Olympic symbols have been constantly cyber squatted, and they not necessarily have trademarks in many places, so that should be included as well. Other point is we could study, or we could suggest the ICANN board to study a mechanism to and basically make owner of a trademark, famous trademark, enforce a claim against different owners of domain name, some type of class action or so. And that's being considered as well. And finally, that all the registrants should be entered on an enhanced searchable WHOIS database, very much in the lines what Steve was suggesting. And these are things that we would like to see in a future enhancement or amendment to the wording of the UDRP. And as Mike said in the beginning, this is probably a more reactive measure. We should start planning on this, and usually this type of changes take a lot of time. So although we are focused now on preventive measures, we have to be prepared to place this up front if those preventive measures would not work, and hopefully we can be working parallelly on this as well. So I don't know if there's any questions.
Guillermo, but you're right, we did say a lot of this is going to be long-term, but I think the one thing that needs to be done immediately and before the introduction of restricted TLDs is that the UDRP must be amended to handle violations of the charter, and Mike had mentioned that as one of our prerequisites. So that, I think, is something that needs to be done immediately rather than long-term and some of the other things Guillermo had mentioned.
Yeah, I think one of the things that it's, I know I've seen in the email traffic that sometimes there are those who take serious issue, and sometimes not very politely so, with ideas that the intellectual property constituency has about protecting IP. And I really think it's fair to say that the IPC is really not about trying to interfere with the progress of the growth of the Internet or the domain name system in any way. What we're about is trying to find an effective but very inobtrusive way of simply protecting IP to make sure that as the system grows, that there is respect for and protection for intellectual property rights, be it trademarks, be it copyrighted material, what have you. So that basically what we want to find is the least obtrusive way of getting this effective protection. And Guillermo's idea is just another way of looking at this in terms of trying to find a way to come in and say, okay, how can we amend the UDRP in ways that will allow us to protect IP, but in ways that will not in any way interfere with the normal functioning and growth of the domain name system. So we are constantly searching for mechanisms of this type, and it's not something that you can come up with overnight. It takes time. Yes, sir.
Just one query, Kim Harkin from Wallet. Given that the daybreak proposal would involve two changes to the existing system, firstly, the right for advertising of the availability of the new GTLD, and secondly, that the registry running the new GTLD would be running for the exclusive benefit of the trademark holders. Has any thought been given to whether or not the owners of trademarks should be required to support financially the advertising and first month process of the TLD?
We have not talked about that. I know I would speaking only personally, that would not offend me at all, because I think that there's no such thing as a free lunch in life, and to the extent that there are some benefits here, I think some contribution would be in order, but that may be a view that will be hooted down by my colleagues in the IPC. You're smiling. You're saying hoot hoot down, Carolyn?
No, I agree with you, and I think there are different views on, I think some people feel that it's a practical matter, knowing how things are going to work, that it's a small price to pay to have that possibility. So yeah, I think many others feel that, especially when they have a solid registration, you know, and or what most of us are arguing will want to pay this mark. They've already spent a lot of money protecting and enforcing and producing this, so then their whole lives are saving helping fund.
So I'm interested in the international viewpoint, because the Australian position is that domain names are Her Majesty's property. As a result, any concession given to any particular people would be trademark holders, persons who have that name on the birth certificate, but it would be people who live on the street of that name, is asking to be a special exception. And if we're setting up an international advertising campaign, and
running registries for them, who have been in college for months. I think the argument is the government, the cost of government.
I think the business constituency might be interested in the game.
Yes, sir.
We are talking of violation of the charter, something which has to be addressed immediately. Violation of charter, what is the sanction? Is it only to withdraw your working register? Is something, is there no sanction imposed on you? Because if it's just a matter of withdrawing your domain name, then it's easier for me to register it and see. If you don't catch me, I take it. Is there any other sanction apart from that withdrawing?
I think at this point, the registrars or the people who will be in charge of the registries would not be willing to take any responsibility. So I think at this point would be a person who feels that their mark's been violated or that those who think they have better rights. And we have to think of putting, by means of our representation, that we declare that have this and that mark or that we have used this specifically for this scope of business. And if someone feels that that's not right, they could go to UDRP. So that's a mechanism that we have been discussing.
Steve?
If I could just add to that, which I think is relevant to your question, and I think it's reflected in our comments, that the UDRP, even an enhanced UDRP, would not be the exclusive means of dealing with these problems of false registrations in a chartered TLD. And I will say that a chartered TLD is very different from a generic. The registrar and registry are undertaking to serve as gatekeepers to some degree, and therefore they should also undertake the responsibility to cancel a registration when it is shown to them that the person who registered it is either not entitled to register in that chartered TLD or is conducting his activities in violation of the charter. So that would be one other means of doing it, and it certainly might also be possible to go to court and have judicial remedies in that case. So there might potentially be other sanctions that would apply.
If I might, what I'd like to do, thank you, Guillermo, I'd like to sort of interrupt at the moment. Roger Cochetti has come to talk with us about some statements that have been made reports that have been made about certain activities of NSI, auctioning, et cetera. So, if I may, Roger Cochetti with NSI.
Thanks, Mike. And first, let me thank you and all of you for having me here. Some of you may know that I spent my first 3.5 years involved in the domain name subject, looking out after IBM's trademark interest. So I feel quite comfortable talking with the intellectual property constituency and certainly understand, I think, many of the concerns that people whose focus is intellectual property would have on a subject like the one I'm about to discuss today. A couple of weeks ago, in late June, we issued a notice to certain of the people who had entered registrations with Network Solutions where they had not paid for the registration for quite a long time, that we were going to take action with regard to that registration, and moreover, that we would take that registration and put it up for auction if they fail to pay on the initial registration fee that they had promised to pay us. Essentially, all of these notices went to registrants who had registered with the NSI registrar prior to the March 10th date on which we became subject to the ICANN accreditation agreements requirements that registrars have a reasonable assurance of payment from registrants. And prior to that date, we had accumulated a reasonable number of unpaid registrations where the registrar had made payment, had booked a registration and made payment to the NSI registry and was stuck holding the bag because the registrant had failed to pay. In all of these cases, the registrants were given first notice, second notice, dunning notice, warning notice, notice that the registration was going to be taken down, notice that the registration had been taken down, notice that we're going to do everything we can to collect the money you owe us, and the measure really was and is, from our point of view, an effort to collect on bad debts or to realize something for the unpaid registrations that we'd already spent money booking. When the notice went around, there was a certain amount of press coverage. I think that the issue raised a number of our action in this area raised a number of questions, and I thought it would be useful to sort of discuss them with you today. In the meantime, because of some questions that were raised, we've notified ICANN that we are postponing the date on which any auctioning activity will take place in order to permit further consultations and discussions like these to ensure that people like yourselves have a full understanding of what we are or are not doing. From the outset, let me make a couple of points. It seems to me difficult for anyone to say that the concept of an auction is a naughty idea. Anyone who's ever gone to Priceline or gone to eBay, anyone who's gone to Amazon or, for that matter, Yahoo or hundreds of other sites on the web understands that auctioning itself is a very effective way to establish the market price for almost anything. And the Internet as a medium is very conducive to auctioning because it permits that sort of wide contact. So that it's hard to imagine anybody who is the least bit interested in electronic commerce these days sort of saying that there's something in the abstract that's bad about auctions. Where auctions can be bad, however, is if you're auctioning off stolen property. I mean, there's nothing wrong with auctioning off TV sets. That's probably a good way to establish the fair market price for TV sets. What's wrong is if you're auctioning off my TV set that somebody else took from me. And I think we're quite aware and conscious of the difference between auctioning off services that are improper and those that are, we think, fully proper. What we've done in our plans for this auctioning activity is several things that we believe are designed to prevent and avoid abuse. And I think taken as a whole demonstrate that our intent here really is essentially to collect on bad debt. The first is that we've made clear that if we receive notice from anyone that we're auctioning off a stolen TV set, then we're not going to auction it. It only takes someone to tell us, that's my TV, don't sell it, then we won't sell it. And obviously, in this case, it means that in any instance where we receive adequate notice from a trademark holder that the domain name that's being put up for auction is their property, then we will not move further on that name. Secondly, and I think most importantly, we've also made clear that this really is not an auction in the normal sense of that term. Normally, auctions are sort of there to collect the maximum amount of money you can get. And if I can get $500 for my TV set, I'll do that. And if I get $5,000, I'll do that. That's not what NSI is doing in this case. What we're doing is simply capping the amount of money we will accept at the amount of money that's due to us, at the amount of the bad debt itself. And as most of you know, the registrar's standard registration rate is $35 a year, so that whoever hits the amount that is the amount due, for those names where no one has objected on the grounds that there's an intellectual property interest of theirs that's being infringed, we will stop at the $35 level. What that means is that there's really no incentive for us to sort of traffic in names that have value because of an infringement or some value that that would lead us to distort our approach to it. We think that safeguards like this are important in demonstrating that it is possible to have legitimate auctions, just as well as we all know it's possible to have improper auctions, but that auctions themselves ought not and should not be condemned as an improper thing to do. They are a widespread and growing practice on the internet, and it is likely that they'll continue to grow as people find new ways to auction off everything from automobile loans to home mortgages and everything else. So that's in a nutshell, Mike, what I wanted to do is kind of give a background, answer any questions that I can. I'm not going to pretend I can answer every question that everybody has, but if I can answer the questions, I will. To assure you all that the purpose and the effect of this effort was in no way to undermine trademark or intellectual property interests, but rather to find a mechanism to collect on bad debts and nothing more than bad debts owed to us.
Roger, I want to thank you for coming. It was in part at my behest. We had tried to arrange a meeting and then decided this would be the best forum. I want to thank you for coming. I have two questions for you, and they came from the members of INTA who are on my internet committee. Some of them are here today, so if I get their questions wrong, I'm sure they'll correct me. The first is adequate notice. My members came back to what does Network Solutions consider to be adequate notice? So if you can answer that. And the second question goes to not so much an intellectual property issue, but an ownership of domain names. There's recently been a decision, Sarah Deutsch just reminded me, the Umbro decision, which said that nobody owns a domain name. And further, last year when I don't know if he's still chairman of the board of Network Solutions, testified before the House IP subcommittee, there's a footnote in his testimony which says that there is no such thing really as a domain name owner, but that there really is, it's really a domain name holder. He made that distinction. So in auctioning off these names, is it Network Solutions' contention that Network Solutions is the domain name owner because nobody else has paid, and why is Network Solutions not returning it into the mix or into the pot, so to speak?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer all of your questions with the precision that they deserve or that you want, and I may have to follow up with you on them and offline. But let me answer the question of equity, sort of why. Why would the NSI registrar take this step instead of returning them to the pool? And I think the simple answer for that is that the registrar is at that point already out of pocket. It's already paid. Our practice is to book a registration and pay the registry at the time that the registration takes place. If the registrant fails to pay, then we're left holding the bag, and it would be unfair to our shareholders to they fail to pay after an extended effort by the service provider to get them to pay. I don't know if that answers your question. I think you had a third part of it, but
The second part was, I don't think that is from you're saying, you know, it's a stolen and instead we are not touching that. We get adequate notice from a legitimate owner. My question is, what do you consider a legitimate claim of prevent the auction?
I did not come to today's meeting with a set of guidelines for what would be, but I would say that it clearly we're looking for people who make a reasonable assertion that they are the holder of the intellectual property and that they've not given permission for it to be used, and obviously we reserve the right to try to filter out people who are scamming us and lying through their teeth and to investigate the claims that people make, but what clearly we would not respond to is a notice from somebody who says, I don't have any rights to this name, but I'm kind of angry that you're, making it available because I don't think that's nice. I mean, that's really okay. That's not our problem. You have to really fit into the category of asserting ownership.
And then back here,
down a couple times,
The first one, I agree with Roger that parking themselves are not bad. They used to be bad. And I think that one of the things that could be happening now is auctioning domains, so almost coming to the garden itself before it's associated with what actually needs to be done. Also, following up on the preceding metaphor, in the case of the TV set, as far as if these names are put up for auction at a time, someone comes along and says, you know, that's somebody stole my TV set, and there it is. Well, and I'm not trying to be sarcastic, but if it was a stolen TV set, then the mark holders would come forward and connect my TV to the report it's stolen to the police, and using that metaphor, maybe we're using the EDRP. Where it becomes interesting or sticky is that it's subjective as to whether that domain name is infringing on some part. And that judgment call seems to be a tough one. And just wanted to share with you. As far as the auctions of domains, as far as you know, someone who auctions domains, whether it's, and I can't speak for eBay or Yahoo or any other auction site, but it actually, basically the only thing you have to go by is the UDRP or you know, the status quo anyway. It's hard to be put in a position where you can make a judgment call like this. So those two things in place, and I think the issue is as far as the UDRP being the mechanism to recover anything that we need.
Can I just one comment, which I think is important to look at this. Given that the maximum amount of revenue we could generate from any single such name is a whopping $35, we don't have a strong incentive to take risks when we receive notice from somebody who's reasonably asserting that this is a trademark infringement. For the whopping sum of $35, you're not going to sort of take a gigantic risk. It's the amount of money, and since we've capped the amount of money, if it was an unlimited auction and we're if somebody was bidding $5 million on something, you might say there's an economic incentive to take a risk. There's very little economic incentive here to take great risks.
You're capping each domain name at $35.
Right. Or it's not that it is the amount that is due to us. Mm-hmm. That depends. So what that means is that when the registration took place, the longest period for which we offer registrations is a 10-year period. The normal is a 2-year period. These are priced at $35 a year, so that the normal one would be $70. Some of them, people did a 1-year registration, in which case it would be $35, but it could...
Per domain name.
Per name, right. So there's not a strong incentive to take a lot of risks.
The lady in the back there.
We really haven't addressed that, and we're certainly not addressed that in this program. This program is aimed at those registrations that are first-year registrations and in which the registrant has failed to respond to repeated invoices, has failed to respond to dunning notices, has failed to respond to cutoff notices, has failed to respond to additional cutoff notices, and these are first-time registrations. In those cases, it seems to us pretty clear that the registrant really has just abandoned the registration. As to whether that is the case or not with somebody who's held the registration and paid for it at one point and then failed to pay for it after similar extensive notices, on a renewal, I don't know. We haven't, we just haven't addressed that. But in the case of new registrations, I think it's an easier call.
Yeah. I just, for clarification, you're talking about a cap on the money you're trying to recover.
The amount due to us is the cap.
I assume that there's no minimum or maximum. There's a set figure for every name that you're trying to recover money on. In which case there's no option. First come, first serve, aside from trademark rights.
First come, first serve on the question if whoever offers the full amount due to us is the first one served. That's correct.
So you publish your names available. Trademark owners, you have 30 days or whatever to oppose, but it's first come, first serve at this price point.
I think not quite that. First come, first serve, if one's willing to offer the full amount, if one offers less than the full amount, then it remains excuse me, available for a specified period of time to see if anybody else would care to come in with a higher.
The full amount won't be any more than what the initial registration was.
Absolutely, correct. That's correct. The amount.
My follow-on question has to do with, I guess, aside from recovery debt, there's no other reason for making these names available, and so that it would be done on initial registrations either. For example, putting up a character trading for auction for the initial registration.
I think there's a completely separate issue that deserves some discussion, but it's not what we're talking about here, which is that what about auctions in other contexts or other kinds of auctions, or are there other opportunities for legitimate auctions that don't threaten the rights of intellectual property holders? And we ought to have that discussion. It would be an interesting one, but what I really came here today, I think it's a complicated enough to talk about this very limited thing that we're doing, and that is only for first-time registrations, and essentially all of these occurred before March 10th in this case.
One of the comments that I'm hearing from some of my colleagues in the IPC is that we appreciate the fact that this is sort of a test run of a type of daybreak proposal. We thank you for that. We look forward to seeing how that's going to work.
Well, but I think it is certainly legitimate for, especially for you all, to be concerned that anybody who's suggesting that they want to do anything like an auction demonstrate, as we think we have, a due regard
right.
for the rights of trademark holders, because it doesn't take a brain surgeon to see how you could conduct an auction that disregards the rights of trademark holders, and that's exactly what we attempted not to do.
My understanding is that you are not giving any consideration or any priority or any preference to the trademark holders regarding this auction of the domain name.
I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't clear. It's quite the opposite. We are... if a trademark holder asserts to us that their rights are being infringed, it's our intention to not proceed with the auction, at which point we would return it to the pool where presumably they would be they would register it. But if you're asking would we then create some separate mechanism for them, frankly we haven't addressed that in any detail, and the normal process is to return the name to the pool, at which point the trademark holder would presumably be the registrant, the normal registrant.
When you say trademark holder, are you talking about, are you including the people, the company, or the holder of the trademark under the other jurisdiction, the trademark law?
Yeah, I'm not in a position to get into a discussion of whether we're doing assignees of trademark rights or holders. I think that the concept that we put forward is that it needs to be a trademark holder, and they need to assert to us that they have rights to that mark, and that they're not authorizing it to be put out in this sort of limited auction. So those are the basic conditions. Whether exactly how that's interpreted, I have a registration in this country, that country, or which country's registrations, I think that would probably be best dealt with either by our legal staff or in a separate, more detailed discussion.
Mike, and then this gentleman here in the front.
Two questions. The first is for Roger, and the second one is actually more of a generic comment or question, and maybe the gentleman from Afton can answer this question. First is, I thought all registrars are supposed to get the money up front for the domains, and so how does this problem come about? I thought you were supposed to collect the money up front, and if I'm mistaken, I do apologize. I do apologize for that. The second question is whether or not organizations like Afternic and even .tv have considered whether or not the auctioning of the names in any way is contributing to cyber squatting, and whether or not they'd be liable under the Anti-Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act in the United States, because there is a provision in there which says that even if you're a registrar and you knowingly engage in a bad faith activity, that is a no-no, and you can be held liable.
I'm sorry, Mike. What was the first question?
Regarded prepayment.
The ICANN registrar accreditation agreement has no provision on prepayment. It has a provision that requires that registrars have a reasonable assurance of payment. In our business, we wind up having a certain number of names for which we had a reasonable assurance of payment where payment doesn't come through. Because the NSI registrar is, you know, does a pretty substantial number of registrations, that means that the normal sort of non-payment rate that anybody would realize, even if we, for example, the normal chargeback rate for most credit card charges in this kind of service area is 2 to 5%. That alone for the NSI registrar would generate several hundred thousand unpaid registrations each year for which it would have taken a credit card charge, paid the NSI registry, and had the registrant or the person charging reject the charge. So there's a considerable number of unpaid registrations that would occur. As to your second question, I think we have taken every possible step to do quite the opposite of what you are describing. Not only are we not intimating or suggesting that there are opportunities for infringers to make a killing out of this, we've capped the amount of money we could take to a relatively modest amount, which doesn't give any incentive for that kind of conduct. And you know, we've made quite clear that the minute we get an adequate notice, it's taken out, taken down. So I think our effort has been to demonstrate that there's a way to proceed with an auction or an auction-like activity that doesn't really raise the kind of issues you were describing.
Yes, I think it was very logical, anything to do with auctioning off the main names in order to collect them. But the original debt will still exist, will it not? Will you be able to collect that debt afterwards again? For instance, sell the amount, for instance, 1,000 small payments that you have in the United States. Or is this going to be transferred to the person that bought?
I think I don't want to play collections lawyer here, but I would say that in my judgment, the registrant still owes us the full amount of money. The chances that you're going to get anything out of these people for $35 items is pretty small, so that there is, I suppose, a theoretical possibility that we would sell the registration for up to $30 and then go after the registrant and collect another $35 and make a killing out of it, but the reality is far from that. The reality is that you won't get $35 a second time around and you'll get nothing the first time around, and we'll be happy to get anything rather than the big fat goose egg that we're sitting on to begin with. So I would say there's absolutely nobody at Network Solutions who's assuming we will make a big money out of this sort of thing. It's really doing the best we can to collect on bad debt.
Yes. Roger, you said you were concerned with the stipulated introduction in order to permit further consultation. Could you tell me who you're consulting with and how long the postponement might last for, and also how you will be announcing to people when the postponement is over? Because we're one of your business account managers, and we had 7 days' notice, which was pretty tricky last time around.
I would say, by the way, the 7 days' notice he's referring to is the sort of what I would describe as sort of final straw for people who had not paid, and had their name taken down, and finally the last notice they got was, your name was taken down a month ago, and we're giving you 7 more days to make a payment, or you know, we're going to do something else with the name, and this is your last chance. So it wasn't that the registrants had in all cases no less than 90 days from the date they made the registration to the date that they got a final notice, and between those first date of the registration.
There was a bit of a row with your accounts people about names that were registered about 2 weeks ago. I just want to know about postponement.
Yeah, and I would say second, the answer to your question is what consultations
yeah.
what I'm doing right now. And any further discussions that any of you would like to pursue with us, we would be most happy to do. We've indicated that we would postpone the commencement of this sort of limited auctioning activity for a period of 40 days to permit these kind of discussions. I don't think our purpose was not to issue press releases on it, but I've told people that. People have called and asked about it, and I think the point is that there's nothing magic in that number, but we felt that if we just said just sort of postponed indefinitely, then that doesn't give any boundary to what we're trying to do, and if I said we're postponing it for 24 hours, that doesn't permit time for people to react to it or give us other ideas or give us suggestions or come up with other ways to collect on the bad debt that we're sitting on. So we try to come up with a reasonable amount of time to promote these kind of discussions. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's about where we are. So I would welcome follow-up to this discussion from any and all of you on the sort of basis that we've described this.
Ms. Park?
Well, my understanding is that when you want to foreclose a sale of your debtor's property, you need to obtain an order from the court to do so. So otherwise, you have to make the restaurant sign an agreement at the outset to make your foreclose a sale possible later.
I think, as I said, there's a principle here that if someone orders something from you and makes no payment, and then you send them an invoice and they make no payment and they give you no response, and they send them another invoice and they make no payment and give you no response, and you send them a warning and they make no payment and give you no response, and you send them another warning and they make no payment and give no response, you send them another warning, they make no payment and give you no response, you send them another notice that I'm taking it back, and they give you no response. You send them another notice saying, I'm about to take it back. They make no payment and give no response. You send them another notice saying, I've taken it back, and they make no payment and give no response. There's a point in that process where you can assume they've abandoned this, that you really, you're dealing with nothing here. And I think we are not assuming at that point that we will hear back from this person, in which they will say, oh, by the way, I'm here, take it back. Or, our presumption is that there is a point in the process where you can reasonably assume that the registrant has abandoned this whole thing if they continue to respond, to fail to respond to anything.
I mean, the gentleman right there.
You said you wanted to recover money from the domain names that have been abandoned to help the shareholders, which is understandable. If you limit the amount that you get from people in the auction to the amount that you're owed, that would be perhaps $35 or whatever. If you put the domain name back in the pool and someone registered it for the 2-year period, which is NSI's requirement, NSI would get $70. Why wouldn't putting the names back in the pool and getting $70 be better for your shareholders than auctioning them, assuming you took out trademark infringement?
I think the simple answer is, first of all, not all the registrations are 2 years. Many of them are for a 1-year period, the 1-year registration. And secondly, our objective at this point is to, as speedily as possible, simply collect on the bad debt. This is a rapid and effective way to collect on bad debt where we're already out of pocket.
The gentleman right there.
You consider yourself a creditor of this debtor, and normally a creditor has to go to the court to recover something that the debtor. And why you consider that you can avoid going to the court?
I think we just went through. I mean, I you were asking the same question, and I'll wind up giving the same answer.
Yeah.
I think there's also a good goodwill, badwill issue here. I mean, a lot of the large trademark owners are some of Benesai's biggest customers, and it just fits really bad to think that all the burden is on the trademark owner to monitor your database every day for potential auctions when here you are, you know, you might register 500 names for my company, and then but you're quick to auction off, you know, an infringing one, and it, I just think it's not going to fit very well when the reality of this starts happening to the trademark community.
Well, I would say, first of all, this is not quick. I mean, there's an extended period during which time the registration was booked, and we were trying to collect the money, but
the trademark owner doesn't necessarily know. All we might know is that the name was taken by somebody, but we don't know it was an unpaid debt or that it's going to be auctioned off. Our only way to know is to get on that website every single day and look to see, you know, if one of our names was found.
I guess I would say that certainly when I represented trademark holder's interest, it was a fact of life that the trademark holder had to do some surveillance. I mean, there was no way, whether if it would put back in the pool, the trademark holder, I would submit, would have to do make no more effort. They would still have to do some surveillance to see what name was available and who was taking it up. The only difference is that if the registration was taken by someone else, they would then have to go through the UDRP or some other process, whereas in this case, they simply have to send a fairly simple notice to us to prevent the auction from taking place. So,
back in the pool, people don't really know one way or the other. The auction creates kind of an artificial highlighting of the availability of that name and creates maybe an inflated expectation of its value.
Well, I think there's two ways to address that. One is to do the sort of notice and takedown, and the other is to limit the amount of money that will be received. Both of those take the incentive of what you described away. So I think they demonstrate that it is possible to have a responsible auctioning activity, although I understand certainly there's nothing that's more infuriating to somebody who owns a TV set to see somebody auctioning off their TV set and somebody else walking away with the proceeds of their own TV set, and that is exactly what we are not doing in this case.
Somebody registers the name of the $3 mark, we go after the person, you know,